From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, our weekly update of news and events from the Latin America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Well, we have a rather full agenda this week, and we'll begin with the just concluded celebration of the 40th anniversary, beginning five decades of independence after the Sandinista Revolution right there in Nicaragua, where you're speaking to us from and where you live.
So yeah, this wasn't just the 40th anniversary of the second revolution to come to power by popular force of arms in Latin America after the Cuban Revolution. It was also the first anniversary of the defeat of the US-backed failed coup attempt that took place between April and July last year.
Yeah.
So it was, and that attempt fell apart. It was finally defeated in its last stronghold on July the 17th last year, when police supported by local people dismantled the barricades in the town of Masaya.
Right.
That was a very important event for people in Nicaragua, because it was the end of what was probably the last gasp in terms of the opposition's political expression here in Nicaragua of having any chance of getting power, because what's happened since then, in the year since that coup was defeated, is that the Frente Sandinista, the ruling political party here, has actually strengthened itself. The coup did achieve the reverse of what it sought achieved the reverse of its original objective, which was to destroy the FSLN as the power of the natural power of government here in Nicaragua. They've done the reverse. They've consolidated the FSLN, and that. So the symbolism of the 40th anniversary was mixed together with the consolidation of the Sandinista Front as the natural party of government here in Nicaragua. And in terms of what happened on the ground, and there was an enormous number of people arriving in Managua, and some people put the numbers something over 500,000. I mean, that's certainly possible, because there were still people trying to get into the outer part of the demonstration in central Managua at about 4 o'clock, 4:30 in the afternoon. There just wasn't room in central Managua for all the people that wanted to take part in the demonstration in the celebration. And it was a celebration. It was more like a rock concert than a political meeting.
Right.
And there were all along the main avenue running up from Lake Managua up into central Managua. It's called the avenue from Bolivar to Chavez. That Bolivar Chavez Avenue is jam-packed. It's a very broad boulevard. It looks like something out of one of the French boulevards or something like that.
Gotcha.
And it was absolutely jam-packed with people. And there were television screens showing people who couldn't reach the main square what was happening in the main square. And one of the interesting things for people in the U.S. that they might like to know is that one of the guests of honor was Brian Wilson. Brian Wilson is the veteran peace activist. Is he not one of the founders of the U.S. organization of ex-military personnel called Veterans for Peace?
Yeah,
and I think he is. And there was a delegation of that organization, Veterans for Peace, up on the podium with the other leading representatives, obviously President Ortega, the Vice President Rosario Murillo, and other people. And there was the Vice President from Venezuela, who gave an extremely fiery, determined speech, and also one of the vice presidents from the Cuban government. There was the prime minister of the tiny country of South Ossetia, which our listeners may remember as one of the countries that separated from Georgia back in, when was it, 2008? And you probably remember better than I do, but he was there and made a very strong speech thanking Nicaragua for its support at the time, because Nicaragua was one of the very few countries that recognized Abkhazia and South Ossetia at the time, when they were struggling for their very existence. And so it was a very interesting event with different elements, and one element that with most people took it, I'm sure it took almost everybody by surprise, was the presence of somebody who was described as, I don't know if this is official, his official title, he was described as the White House chaplain. I mean, a guy called, I think his name is the Reverend something something Rollinger, I've forgotten his first names. But he was there, and apparently he organizes Bible study groups for the members of the U.S. Senate and members of the U.S. House of Representatives. So we had this extraordinary situation where the revolutionary government of Nicaragua had invited as their first speaker at this massive celebration of their 40th anniversary, the chaplain to their most vehement enemy. And it was a really extraordinary moment. Right. And Rollinger made this speech saying, we are a Christian country in the United States. And you could almost hear everybody doing a big intake of breath at the sheer audacity of that ridiculous assertion. You know, and it may be that a large number of people in the United States go to church, but to suggest that the United States government is in any sense a Christian-inspired outfit is just beyond absurd anyway. Yeah. And everybody listened to him very politely. And when he finished, the Vice President, Rosario Murillo, gave the podium to a very well-known local liberation theology priest called Father Tony Castro, who's renowned for his humility and utter commitment, a lifetime of commitment to vulnerable people at grassroots. And Padre Tony he was invited to give the reflection prior to beginning the main speeches. And he said, well, before I start my reflection, what I'd like to do is invite my brother evangelical pastors from the United States to take advantage of their position, and when they return to Washington, to insist with the U.S. authorities that they lift the sanctions against Nicaragua and also Venezuela. So that was a wonderful retort to Rollinger's absurd statement about the United States being a Christian country. And it set the stage for a very passionate speech, both by the Cuban vice president and in particular by Delcy Rodriguez, the Venezuelan vice president, which very much foreshadowed an event that's just finished in Caracas, the Foro Sao Paulo. And one of the key themes of one of the key themes of the 40th anniversary event in Managua this year was the insistence on peace, the insistence on the need to promote international unity, to isolate the United States as a rogue state imposing sanctions in a way in complete violation of international law, and also insisting on the need for all popular movements in Latin America to unite and remain firm in resisting what now looks more and more like an extremely weak counteroffensive, the counteroffensive that we've seen ever since, for example, the Honduran coup, the right-wing counteroffensive at a continental level that we've seen ever since the military coup in Honduras, ever since the coups against Rafael Correa and Evo Morales back in 2009, 2010, 2011, the so-called soft coup against Fernando Lugo in Paraguay, and the subsequent soft coup, so-called soft coup in Brazil that overthrew the government of Dilma Rousseff and led to the imprisonment of Lula da Silva. All that whole process is now very clearly winding down. It's lost it whatever momentum it had, and that too was very much a theme in Delcy Rodriguez's speech. The right wing are not going to be able to achieve their objectives, and here in Nicaragua, the fact that this was also the first anniversary of the failure of the US-backed coup attempt last year, that's summed up in a slogan that they have here, no pudieron, they couldn't do it, ni podrán, nor will they ever be able to. I mean, that's the coup, that's the slogan, and that's very much a slogan that is in vogue in Venezuela as well and elsewhere in the continent. So that in all kinds of ways, both at a national level and at a regional level, because of the people who are speaking at that event, it was a very it encapsulated the main themes that are likely to be kind of set the agenda, as it were, certainly for the rest of the year and well into next year.
You know, it's interesting. There's a whole context that this takes place within, of course. We've had the non-aligned meeting with basically people closing ranks around Venezuela. We've had the counter moves, Pompeo making his tour through the area last week. Iran's foreign minister.
He went to Argentina, Ecuador, Mexico, and El Salvador, reinforcing his links with right-wing leaders in Argentina and Ecuador, cementing a new link with the kind of social democrat center-right President Bukele in El Salvador, who's likely to follow a neoliberal agenda there.
Right.
And in Mexico, and I think his main concern was to talk to the authorities there about ref policy with regard to migrants entering the United States.
Right. So he's running through the area. Iran's foreign minister, who you had a chance to see also in Nicaragua, but visiting Bolivia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and elsewhere in the region.
That was a fascinating conversation that he had with the journalist at the press conference that I attended, also attended by U.S. journalists Max Blumenthal and Ben Norton, and also the British journalist Steve Sweeney from the Morning Star, a London progressive paper.
Mm-hmm. Tell us.
And Zarif was asked, in the context of your presence at the non-aligned meeting in Caracas, and what is your view about the role of economic sanctions, given that both Iran and Venezuela are victims of that? And I also asked him if there was any sense that countries in the non-aligned movement were likely to unite to take specific concrete steps against U.S. terrorism, like in Iran. They've suffered terrorist attacks from groups supported and funded and supplied by the United States, as did Nicaragua all through the 1980s. And Venezuela is now, there was that recent attack over the last few days, killing by paramilitaries, apparently from Colombia, who killed six Chavista land workers, I think. And that was a terrible attack. The kind of technological terrorism that they use. In Iran, they use Stuxnet, that kind of viral computer virus phenomenon that they use to attack Iran's technological infrastructure. And in Venezuela, they've been using similar kind of a high-tech tax to destroy the capacity of the electrical generating system there, right, which we saw again just over the last week. And what Zarif said was he didn't say anything specific about that, but he did say that there is all the countries in the non-aligned movement, or the majority of the countries in the non-aligned movement, agree that they have to consolidate and combine to defend themselves against the illegal use of sanctions by the United States, right, and also by the U.S. government-sponsored terrorism against their country. So, in some ways, there was nothing new there. But as you say, it's the context that makes that important.
Yeah. And you have that effort and the counter effort going on at all of those levels. There's also this group that the right wing is trying to revive again, to use as a center to organize. They haven't been able to use the they've gotten maximum value out of the OAS, but it hasn't been sufficient to allow them the cloak of legitimacy for military intervention in Venezuela, and now they're making a move towards that again in another venue, under the Regional Mutual Assistance Treaty.
Yeah, and there's that. Just prior to the tours of the region by Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif and the U.S. Is Pompeo the Secretary of State now?
Yes.
And U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, they it's as if they were kind of doing a pas de deux, a kind of duet in diplomatic terms, but going against each other in the region. But immediately prior to their visits, the Organization of American States held one of its assemblies in, and I think it was in Bogota, or maybe not Bogota, but somewhere in Colombia. I think it was Bogota. And one of the objectives of the United States at that meeting, I think it was a meeting of the Permanent Council, I'm not sure, or maybe it was a meeting of foreign ministers. But anyway, it was one of the main OAS high level meetings, and what they were trying to do at that meeting was to expel Nicaragua and activate what they call the Carta Democratica, the OAS Democratic Charter, that would authorize members of the Organization of American States under international law to impose sanctions on Nicaragua, which the U.S. is currently doing unilaterally. And what they did was they tried to introduce representatives of the Nicaraguan opposition into the meeting, and they pulled all kinds of theatre, but in substance they achieved nothing, because they just don't have the votes. They don't have the votes in the OAS to isolate Nicaragua. Sorry, just let that siren go by.
Oh, that reminds me. I know where it was. It was in Medellin. Go ahead.
Right. Okay. So as you just reminded me that the meeting was in Medellin in Colombia.
Yes.
And in the OAS, the United States simply doesn't have the votes to achieve the kind of measure that they wanted to.
Right.
Mainly because Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela have been tremendously successful in explaining the reality of the situation in their different countries to the Caribbean island nations, mm-hmm. the members of CARICOM. Mm. And it's those Caribbean island nations who, as a bloc, have been largely responsible for thwarting U.S. attempts and right-wing attempts by right-wing allies in the region, like Chile and Argentina and Colombia itself, to implement damaging measures against Nicaragua. Yeah. And of course, Cuba isn't a member of the OAS and doesn't want to be. And of course, Venezuela is actually withdrawn from the OAS. Right. So that failure, coming immediately prior to the events we've just been discussing, the visit of Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif to the region, and the successful Foro Sao Paulo, the continuing failure of U.S. Sanctions to force a change in Venezuela's government. I mean, at the Foro Sao Paulo, should we explain to listeners what the Foro Sao Paulo is?
Just a general outline of the forum.
Foro Sao Paulo is an organization that was founded back in the early 90s,
right.
Shortly after the dissolution of, I think it was in 1991, of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, actually 1990 when they, and it came from the Workers' Party in Brazil. It was their initiative.
Right. Yeah. It was Lula and Fidel.
Yep.
Lula da Silva, Brazil's Lula da Silva, and Cuba's Comandante Fidel Castro. They decided that it was absolutely imperative to set up a forum in which all the progressive movements of Latin America and the Caribbean could meet as equals and discuss the matters of the day, urgent matters of the day, how to develop a common progressive agenda, recognizing differences in from one country to another, how to encourage coordination of policies towards regional integration, towards towards ideas based on peace, towards ideas of social policy and economic policy based on the human person in the region. And that, these are just fundamental characteristics of the Foro Sao Paulo's approach to politics and economics and social policy in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Now, the first meeting was in 1990 in July, but it was called then the Meeting of Left and Anti-Imperialist Parties and Organizations of Latin America, and in 1991 Mexico City meeting, the follow-up, they began calling it the Foro de Sao Paulo.
Right.
So we're both right.
That characteristic of anti-imperialism is also absolutely fundamental to the movements and governments that take part, the political parties that take part in the Foro Sao Paulo. And it's principally for political parties and political movements across the region. And so and one of the ironies of the early days of the Foro Sao Paulo was something that Nicolas Maduro remarked upon in his closing speech at the Foro Sao Paulo, was that in the early days of the Foro Sao Paulo, they wouldn't accept the presence of Comandante Hugo Chavez, because they were suspicious of his military background. And they feared that he was just
right, a plant.
He might be just another military dictator on the make. So, and isn't that ironic?
Yes, it is. Oh, it was his birthday yesterday, by the way. Or today? Yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. And so his in the closing speeches that they made, and there was the figure of Hugo Chavez, especially because the Foro Sao Paulo was taking place in Caracas, was he absolutely dominated. He was kind of loomed over the whole proceedings, not in a sinister way, but right. In an inspiring way.
That's right.
Because of his incredible achievements.
That's right.
So then, in both their speeches, President Miguel Díaz-Canel of Cuba and President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, and they too emphasized the very same messages that came out in the speeches that were made on July 19th here in Nicaragua, in Managua, by President Daniel Ortega, by Vice President of Venezuela, Delcy Rodriguez, and by the visiting Vice President of Cuba. I think Cuba has three vice presidents. Yeah, I think the guy who spoke, Salvador Valdez, I think he's the first vice president. Anyway, and in all those speeches, they were insisting on the the firmness and the firm resolution, the determination of left-wing governments and left-wing political movements in the region to resist U.S. policy and to ensure that the current phase of right-wing ascendancy, which is now in decline and decay, does in fact bite the dust. I mean, that was Nicolas Maduro in particular was very clear about that. He spoke about the different phases over the last 20, 25 years that politics in the continent has gone through, and he said very much as it happens. Confirming what you and I have been arguing for the last year, year and a half, 2 years, we are now entering a fourth phase in which the decline and decay of right-wing policies that have no future in terms of the economic, social, and moral needs even, or cultural needs even, of the region's peoples. Those policies are failing, and we're now entering a new phase in which there will be a counterattack by the progressive forces of the continent, and that we're likely to see. He also agrees that the initial sign of that will be a victory for the Frente de Todos, which is the center-left progressive political movement that's likely to win the elections in Argentina at the end of the year, and also in Bolivia, where Evo Morales is likely to win re-election again, I think, for a fourth term in Bolivia. And so Maduro reinforced what Daniel Ortega and Delcy Rodriguez and the others were saying on the 19th, saying that we're not only are we not going to collapse and give in, but we are going to go on to the counteroffensive. I thought that was a tremendously encouraging note to strike at this particular time, in particular when Venezuela is under such serious threat of potential military action. You know, perhaps not direct invasion, certainly a kind of war of attrition from Colombia and perhaps from Brazil too. So, and that message was tremendously important.
It's interesting that just the way that this has evolved since the beginning of this year, when they tried to install President Hu in Venezuela by remote control, and literally, you know, we saw the attempted assassination last year of President Maduro by drone. You remember that incident at the celebration?
It was very serious.
And then, you know, it's kind of like, well, why? What do they have planned? You know, other than chaos? And you see that. Oh, they had Guaido like waiting in the wings. He would have stepped right into the booth, you know, and shook his fist at the drone or whatever, and been president like in 5 minutes, and that would have been that. And the next day, he'd be holding a joint press conference with Lenny Morena talking about a new day. But it's just watching how the whole situation has evolved in Latin America from the beginning efforts of Chavez, certainly. I mean, you can go back to Bolivar even, but the institutional resilience that was developed and nurtured as resistance to the U.S. imperialism in the area, so far, you know, it's shown that's somewhat elastic. You know, there were many great gains made, and then certainly some losses since 2015. But it seems that the pendulum has swung the other way again, and there's an awful lot of what was built that's been left intact. Is there to build on now moving forward?
The reason that the coup fell apart is because the government enjoyed massive support from the population.
And that's where the battle gets fought, and that's where that battle was won, and that's where we have to leave it today. Thank you very much, and we'll speak with you again next week. And, Tony, thanks.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. I'll look forward to talking to you next week.
Yes, and will I.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.